I'm Bob Banks, member of Sabre. I'm here talking with Lenny Morello at his home in Reading, Massachusetts on November 9th, 1994. Lenny, you had a fine major league playing career with the Chicago Cubs from 1941 through 1947. Would you tell us some of the highlights for you during those days playing with the Chicago Cubs?
Well, Bob, I look at my career, and I'm grateful for you using that term, fine career. As far as stats and so forth were concerned, it wasn't a great career or a fine career, but it was a baseball career, and I was their regular shortstop for those years. However, I like to look at it this way, Bob. I played with some outstanding players, and I played against some outstanding players, and those memories will always stay with me. And surprisingly, how, though in the twilight of my life, this was getting down towards the age of 80, I'm getting close to that, those things happen like it was just yesterday, and they always come back. And I think that's what baseball is all about, the friendship of the players that you played with and against. And the memories, they're wonderful.
You do have the privilege of having played in the 1945 World Series with the Cubs, and that,
yes,
of course, is the last World Series that the Cubs have ever been in.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit there of your memories of that.
Well, the 1945 World Series, and I like to think of all the great ball players that have played with the Cubs and have never been in the World Series. Now, there's been some outstanding players. Ernie Banks, for instance. We all know Ernie Banks. Let's play two. Let's play three. You know, a great shortstop, great hitter, so forth. His one wish was that he could have played in the World Series. And every time I see Ernie Banks, and I see him once in a while because he's there and everywhere, and I always kid him about that. He kids me about it, you know. But about that 45 World Series, I didn't even start in that World Series. And I think I played 139, about 152, 154 ball games that year. I played in every ball game, but right there towards the end, I get in there where I was a little erratic, and we had a good veteran backup infielder. And Charlie Grimm invited me to have dinner with him just prior to the World Series after we clinched it against Pittsburgh. I'll never forget it. And Charlie Grimm was great. He says, Len, he said, look, you've given us a great year. I'm going to start Hughes at shortstop. Well, you can just imagine the feeling that I had gone through. But just the fact that he brought me in and explained everything to me, and he said, but I'm going to get you in there just as soon as I can. He said, we're going to have a few days where we can just relax and rest and, you know, get everything going again. And he was very, very good about it. But it was heartbreaking not to play in every ball game in that World Series. And we lost the heartbreaker. In that sixth game, I was spiked in the arm. I'm on the trainer's table getting stitched. And we wanted an extra innings in that sixth ball game. And we were going to start Hyde Vandenberg in the crucial seventh game. We had a day off, and then the seventh game was going to come up after that. And the clubhouse was, you know, wild. And here I'm laying there getting stitched. And then Hank Barowe, who was our big ace and our big pitcher, who came in to relieve that particular game when we won it. And I heard the next voice was Hank Barowe. He said, Skip, I'll be ready for that big game. He says, I'll go right to bed right after that, get all the rest I can. And Charlie Grimm says, you're my man. I'll never forget that. He said, you're my man, Hank. Okay? So, anyway, Hank started the seventh game. I think they got 5 runs on him the first day. He did his best, but he was just worn out. That's the thing I remember most about
that. He pitched 4 innings, I think, in relief in that sixth game. So he had quite an assignment.
I think he won. He pitched all through the World Series. I don't know just what his record was. He and Paso are our aces, you know, as you know, at 45. But I was here. I was laying there getting stitched. The clubhouse was going wild, and then this is the thing that sticks in my mind most about that particular World Series.
Your forte as a player was your defensive skill.
Yeah, I was a shortstop.
And there was one day there where human nature took over and your mechanical skills took a back seat. Tell us the boot story.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, it happened in Boston, my hometown. I was born and raised right in East Boston, and as a kid went to all the ball games at Bracefield, on the, you know, as a member of the Knothole gang, a nickel to get in, and a nickel car fare in, a nickel car fare back, and I was a National League fan from where we'd go, and naturally when I got caught up being a Cub follower because of Ralph Wheeler, who was a sports editor for the Boston Herald, and he would take me and work out with the Cubs when they come in, because that was his favorite team, and it was my favorite team too, because they were great ball club. And the excitement of just working out with the Cubs in those days was something, you know. That's what they used to do. Get you out there, put a uniform on you, go sit in the corner of the clubhouse near the showers. They throw a big uniform at you. You put it on, and your ears were bigger than your head. You listen to all the ball players talking. But then they got you out of there as quickly as possible, get you on the ball field, and give you a chance to work out with the team. But anyway, on September the 13th, 1942, we come in there, and we were in New York, playing in New York, and I got the word that Gene was in labor. So Charlie Grimm says, get out of here, get home. I jumped on the train and got home and to East Boston, and she was hospitalized at the New England Hospital. But the baby didn't come until the next day. But meanwhile, the club came up to Boston, right, playing at Bracefield, and I took her to the hospital that night, stayed with her. Our first son was born, our first child was born. Early that morning, went out to Bracefield, I broke the major league all-time record, making 4 errors in 1 inning. And I'll never forget coming in. Of course, we won the ball game easily. It was a big scoring ball game. And of course, the fellas kidded about it. They knew about the baby was born. And Howie Roberts was a writer for the Chicago Daily News and a tremendous friend and a good writer. Because in those days, the writers would travel with you and they were on the trains with you, you know. No planes back then. And so we got to know the writers well. And his headline the next day was, Boots is born, Marullo Boots 4. That's the headline, which I still have kept. And, that's the day that Boots was born. He's now going on his 53rd birthday. That was 1942, September the 13th.
And his friends still call him Boots?
They still call him Boots, right? Yeah, and, oh yeah, he's quite a guy. And, of course, they kid him a lot. You know, they'll say to him, how'd you get that name? Things like that. How'd you get that name? Of course, he tells the story.
Well, I know Dizzy Dean rated you as one of the best defensive shortstops that he had ever seen. So there's got to be some credence to...
you mentioned Dizzy Dean, Bob. Now, that's a story in itself, because when Dizzy had the sore arm, my first year in baseball, along with Eddie Wakis. Eddie Wakis had played a couple of years of minor league baseball. He did not go to college. I did. I went to Villanova. And we joined up, my first year in baseball was with the Texas Club in the Texas League, okay? The Tulsa Club in the Texas League. And that was the year that Dizzy had the bad arm. I think he had the bad arm, pitched in the World Series with the bad arm and so forth. But now they sent him to the Texas League because they figured the hot weather would help the most. So he spent that whole year with us, a bunch of young fellas, like myself, in baseball, starting out. What a thrill that was to have him on the ball club. So we'd fill that ballpark everywhere we went. And we were treated royally, you know, and it was a great, great experience. It seemed like every time Diz pitched, I had a good game behind him. Because, you know, he's throwing sidearm, he's throwing that sinker ball, and the ball would be on the ground most of the time. So if it were an infielder back in those, he had many, many, many chances. But it was nice of him to say that.
So you were signed to a professional baseball contract coming out of Villanova?
Yes, yeah.
And who was the scout that signed you?
Well, it was actually Jack Doyle that was following me around, but it was Ralph Wheeler, as I mentioned him before. Ralph Wheeler was a sports writer for the Boston Herald. He was a little guy, suspenders, pants and short, you know, the pants were always above the... He was a character. In love with baseball. Married to baseball. Was never married. Never had any children. But he had more children than you can ever think of. Baseball was his, the name of his game. That was his family. He operated the Marlins City Club. Totally by himself. But he also started and ran the Suburban League, which was the strongest league here in eastern Massachusetts, or the best, probably the best league in New England. And he always had a strong ball club. And that was, to me, I've always said that Ralph Wheeler was the best judge of talent because he had more kids that made good in professional baseball than anybody that I can ever remember. And he was never a scout. But he loved the Cubs. He loved Charlie Grimm. He loved Red Corridon. He loved Roy Johnson, his coaches. And he loved Mr. Wrigley. They treated him well. For some reason or other, he got in pretty close. So if he had a kid that he liked, when the Cubs came in town, he made sure he got them over there early, introduced them around, and they gave you a chance. They put a Cubs uniform on you and let you work out with the ball club. Actually, now when it's really a long story how I wound up going to Villanova. It was because of Ralph Wheeler. He helped so many kids get a scholarship to go to school. I never thought I'd ever go to school. I went to East Boston High School, taking the commercial course. I'll never forget it. Now, he saw me play in high school. I was a 15-year-old senior, captain of the high school team. 15 years old. Now, you might say, now, that's impossible. Well, it wasn't in those days, because the teachers would give you a double promotion. And I think, as long as you did your work and did, you know, kept your nose clean, and I was one of these kids, I could always draw, as a good printer, was very neat. When the honor roll time come out, she'd have me, my fifth grade teacher, have me put a scroll with a feather through it and put all the boys' names or the girls' names and girls' names were on the honor roll. I was one of those kids, and she thought I was bright enough to skip the sixth grade, so I went to the seventh grade without going to the sixth grade. So here I am, graduating high school, turning 16 on May the 5th and graduating in June. Never think about Ralph was at a ball game. Evidently, he had seen me play a number of times. He finally came up to me and he said, I'll never forget it. I know who he was. Every kid playing ball knew who Mr. Wheeler was. He said, what course are you taking? And I'm saying to myself, what kind of a question is that? And I very proudly said, I'm taking a commercial course. He said, that's too bad. I said, why? He said, you can't go to college with a commercial course. You have no credits. I said, I'm not going to college. He said, yes, you are. He pointed his finger at me. I thought he was going to stick his finger right up my nose. He's right up on top of me, little guy. He said, I am. He says, I'm going to come over and talk to you about my father. I said, no, please don't. He said, why? I said, they'll throw you out of the house. I'm going to go to work just like my brothers and sisters. I said, I'm one of 12, 9 boys and 3 girls. He said, I'm coming over anyway. My mother practically threw him out of the house. But he convinced him. I wound up, he got me a scholarship to St. John's Prep. And all those years, I thought I had a full scholarship. You know, those days, it cost $600, room, board, and tuition to go to St. John's. Room, board, and tuition. I thought I had a full scholarship. I had a half scholarship, and he paid the other half. I didn't know it. And from there, I got a scholarship. I was going to go to Holy Cross, playing down the Cape League. I had St. John's Prep. I was going to go to Holy Cross, where every kid wanted to go. If he thought he was going to be a ball player, it was a great school, Holy Cross. It was the team to beat in New England. I was playing down the Cape with a second baseman named Cowboy Crawley. Both of us were going to go to Holy Cross. We were all okay. And it was a great, one of the great, football players at Notre Dame, one of the four horsemen, okay, was the football coach at Villanova. And he's down on the Cape. He's going to give a talk for U.S. Steel. I'll never forget it. And he came to the ball game. And then he came to the ball next day. We all were told, hey, that's Harry Stuhlgren, a little bull-legged guy, a little guy. That's the great football player out of that, one of the four horsemen. Next thing you know, he's got Cowboy and Crawley and I aside, and now a manager. And he said to me, particularly, he said, you all set to go to Holy Cross? I said, yes, I am. He said, you do have have a scholarship there. I said, yes, I have. He said, would you be interested in going to Villanova? He said, but you're going to tell me you like football. Oh, I said, I don't play football. I said, that's not what I asked you. Do you like football? I said, I love it. He said, well, I want you to think about it. He said, you get a job. He said, you'll have to give you a full scholarship. I'm going to give the both of you a full scholarship to Villanova. And I'm going to ask the two of you, you're going to have to be at the football practices, and I'm going to take you both to our away games on during the football season, but you're going to have to write for the Villanova, you know, what's going on the football field. You're going to have to do that. Geez, our eyes are getting bigger and bigger. The more we talk, the better we liked it. Of course, this was Stonebridge talking to us. Before the day was over, we had, the heck with Holy Cross, we're going to go to Villanova. That's how we wound up going to Villanova. Harry Stonebridge. Yeah. And he treated us royally. But the thing I'll never forget, we had one road game outside the games against Fordham and Manhattan and New York. And that one road game was the only game that they lost in 3 years at Villanova. Of course, he left Villanova after my sophomore year. He went to St. Wisconsin. And Clipper Smith became the coach. And the only game they lost was to Johnny Kimbrough, the great All-American fullback at Texas A&M. Oh, yeah. And I saw that game at College Station. They lost it 24-7.
Yeah. After your playing career was over with the Cubs, then you continued to work with them as a scout.
Yes.
And did you have a mentor or a person that helped you in the get started as a scout?
No, well, I'll tell you why. I had a sciatica condition, and I was not the type you could say you'd have a chance to be a utility ball player. A lot of them stay on as a utility, play second, play third, and swing the bat once in a while. I had a sciatica condition at 48. I was with the ball club all of 48, but I didn't play because of the sciatica condition and waiting to make all kinds of treatments, lay in the hospital for 2 weeks and this and that. But anyway, I had decided I got a college education. I got my degree. I want to be a teacher coach and stay with baseball, okay? My roommate of 9 years was Phil Cabaretta. They called us the Grand Opera Twins. We're always together, two Italian boys. And we're always together. Of course, he was the captain, he was the star, and I was his pal, I was his friend. He was a very, very high-strung boy, player, outstanding, and the mattier got him, the better ball player he was. And I was supposed to be the guy that keep him at an even keel all the time. And I knew him so well, we were both good for each other. We got along great. He became the manager of the Cubs. They came into Boston. And when they come into Boston, I go visit him and talk about him. The next thing I know, he's managing the Cubs, and Whit Matthews is the coach. And I was working for the Prince Macaroni Company. I figured, you know, just a part-time, a man that I met through baseball, Mr. Pellegrino. He said, you come in and see me when you're done. He said, I got a good future for you, and so forth and so on. Just for a short time. Now, when the Cubs are in town and doing this business, the next thing I know, Phil Cabaretta and Whit Matthews have me in his office along with Ray Hayworth, who was his special assignment man with the Cubs. And next thing I know, they caught me in being their New England scout. Back in those days, the Cubs didn't have many scouts at all. They didn't pay anything either. I was making 12.5 with the Prince Macaroni Company, you know, and then they offered me a contract of $4,500 to scout. He said, we're only going to ask you to work during the spring and the summer. That's all. And you can do whatever you want during the off season. I came home and talked to the over Jean. She was great. Yeah, she's been great. She said, if that's what you want to do, I will get by. Left that kind of a job with a short time. With a good future. Had a good future with them. We could speak Italian. The product and the idea was to open up a chain of restaurants, which was one of the Prince Spaghetti House in Boston. They're going to have it in all the big cities. But anyway, I left that to go back to baseball. I had a salary of $4,500 and 10 cents a mile. get your meals. But I never regretted one minute.
And then you continued to scout for the Cubs up to 1973.
Right, yeah.
And while you were scouting with the for the Cubs, you must have signed some prospects that eventually became major leaguers. Who were some of those people?
Well, you know, there's a little booklet here that I put aside. It's called the Scout of the Year. Well, I don't know whether you ever saw it.
No, I haven't.
But I was selected as the Scout of the Year, and I'm very, very proud of it.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And I dug this up, and I'm going to give it to you, Bob. So you asked me who I signed. Something that was always drilled into me by Ray Hayworth and Mr. Wrigley, who I felt I was very, very close to. Mr. Wrigley would come to our meetings, our first meeting every year. This would be right in the Wrigley building. He'd be up in his conference room, and the scouts around the table, he'd attend now, just that one meeting, and they'd say the same thing every year. Same thing. But we don't ever feel that you signed this guy, or he signed this guy, he signed this guy. This is the Chicago Cubs organization. No one man ever signs a person because there's more than one man involved. You might have seen him first, but you've been given an awful lot of help in signing different boys because other men come in and double check you and so forth. But you do the groundwork, and that's what scouting is all about. So many fellows get, and they rightfully so, get a pat on the back or, you know, for signing this guy and signing that guy. But I did have the list. They listed some players that players signed by myself and Chicago. Mo Drabowski, Mo Mohan, Dave Stenhouse, Danny Murphy, Gordon Massa, Mike Gordon. But also there are other players
that you were involved with. That
that's right. Because we used to cover the professional leagues.
Yeah.
In the summertime, I'd either do even doing the New York Penn League, Pete Rose. I saw Pete Rose play his first year. That's a great story in itself. We do double-A baseball. We do double-A baseball. You know, I've done different leagues. I've done the International League. I'll never forget being sent in to see Glenn Beckett. But they didn't tell us who on that particular ball club. But see, there was a rule back in those days that you, after a player's first year, if you did not put him on the major league roster, any club could draft him for $8,000. $8,000. $8,000. Clemente was drafted for $4,000 because he wasn't protected on the big league roster after playing up in Montreal. But Glenn Beckett, anyway, was, you had him. He was a kid out of Allegheny College. Next Cup teammate of mine, the third string catcher, Bob Garbach. Well, the early years that I was with the Cubs, he was with the Cubs. And I went to Villanova with Mike Garbach, his brother was signed with the Yankees. So anyway, it was easy for me to get all the information and on the background and so forth because of Bob Garbach. But I was sent into that in the Mid-Atlantic League and saw it. And he was my prime player on that particular ball club as a shortstop second baseman. As a shortstop, he became an all-star in the National League for many years. Not on my, but my report helped draft. That's how we get involved when we do a professional baseball. And it's interesting. You know, so there are many, many, many players that you don't get credit for, but in the background, you had something to do with them being drafted.
Now, when
drafted or signed.
As a scout, you'd have techniques to rate them on their speed and hitting ability and fielding and so forth. Did you also have your own techniques for trying to get inside a player's head to see what they were like?
Well, you know, I've heard many times, Bob, you can't cut a boy open and look inside. That's almost impossible to do. But you can get to know a player. You get to know him, and this is all strictly instincts. What type of person are you? Myself. I've always been the type of person that's been able to get along with young players, families. I've been able to go because I think it's because of my background. I was very fortunate to be able to get an education. But I come from a family of 12 who's appreciated every little thing that's ever been done for us, 9 boys and 3 girls. All this enters into it. I find it so easy, and I love to do it. Number one, because people respect a person if he's connected with baseball until he proves otherwise. And usually it's easy to walk in the house because you're representing baseball. They're anxious to hear you, or they're anxious to see you, or they're anxious to visit with you. And that's what I love about this job. And basically, that's how I work with the Major League Scouting Bureau. They can't wait. Hey, the easiest thing for me to do is make a phone call, like I did just the other night to the Shane family up there at Drakeford, Massachusetts. The boy is a shortstop at the University of Lowell. He's a junior this year. He's eligible. He's a good-looking ball player. Good-looking player. You know, there was some questions. How much is he going to hit? Hey, to get the hitting, makes contact with the ball. If he can do the other things, arm and field and run, and just his instincts of the game. I call his family, mother answered the phone, and when I explained to her who I was and why I was calling, she was thrilled. Oh, she said, all this boy of mine has ever wanted to do is to be a ball player. I said, well, you're a fine boy, and I'm sure he has a future for that. I'm not guaranteeing anything, but hey, I'll be right on top of him all next spring. You know, you talk to them like that, but they love hearing from you. No better feeling.
Did you feel that while you were scouting, there was competition between the scouts, and like, do you feel that you would see something in a prospect that other scouts would be missing?
Yeah, well, some of us scouts do have an advantage over other scouts. We've been a part of it. Frankly, I like to see, I hope he doesn't have a bad day, but very few boys have a day that you hope that he has. He knows you're there. He's trying harder than ever. He's pressing a little bit. You have to take all these things into consideration. When I see a boy have an off day, or a day that you know, hope that he wasn't having, you know, it's not a good day at the plate, or, you know, just making miscues or misjudging for all of it. Every boy goes through that. I like to see that. I like to see what his reaction is. How does he react to it? And I think that's very, very, very important. Boy boots one. Now you can, if you had glasses, you could put the glasses right on him. Look at his face. Does he want the ball again? You can read that. And I think that's something that comes from being around baseball all the time and being able to read a player. That's very, very important.
Do you have any memories of mistakes or goofs that you made that you just soon take back, anything in that area?
Well, there's a lot of players that have been signed. Drafted in the first round, drafted in the high rounds. I didn't see him as that strong a prospect. Or the other way around. Well, the boys I think of, hey, this kid can be a number one, two, or three. That's the way we grade them. You know, we look at them, we have a little corner on the sheets. We have more paperwork than you can ever realize. Well, today it's all paperwork. What do you think this boy should be drafted to the second, third, or from the fourth to the ninth, or from the ninth to the 18th? We have to have a pretty good idea where he will be drafted, or should be drafted, so to speak. Usually we very close, very, very close.
Are the rating forms that the scouts use, are they uniform? Pretty uniform?
Yes. Yeah.
So each scout is kind of doing the same thing. You've got the stopwatch and you've got your form that you're putting numbers down.
You forget the radar gun.
The radar gun, yeah. When did that come in?
Sorry you did it. And it's very useful.
You compare notes with other scouts when you're there together.
Our organization.
Well, when you're there as a scout for the Cubs, and there's somebody else that's scout with the Mets and so forth, do you say, you know, compare, hey, how do you look to see him, or do you keep it pretty much to yourself?
Yeah. Number one, a good scout is a loner. He doesn't sit with other scouts, but that's almost unavoidable. Almost unavoidable. They like to gather around home plate, behind the plate. That's a no-no. Visiting and talking and comparing notes, that's a no-no. But scouts are human beings. They're very proud of their talent. They're very proud of being a scout. And unknownst to what they're doing sometimes, they're practically talking out loud. Sometimes it's to impress the others. Yeah. But that is not, that's something that it's definitely a no-no. You don't talk about ball players, you don't talk about your ball club is paying you for your evaluation, not others' evaluation. And I like to use the expression, you have to scout with your eyes, not with your ears. And unfortunately, we have fellas that are always looking for help, get their ears open and not seeing what they're supposed to be seeing. Putting down what they see, well, instead of what they hear.
What are some of the changes that you see in the prospects today compared with yesteryear?
Some of the changes?
Yeah.
The players today?
The players, yeah. Yeah, you're scouting.
Well, I think it's all for the better. You know, I hear tone over and over again, you don't see the arms, you don't see the legs, you don't see the raw tools that we saw years ago. It's true, and I really believe this, you do not see the arms that every kid had years ago. They're brought up differently. It's a different, and I can go on and explain that. That's my own personal feelings on it. But today, Bob, the kids are bigger, they're stronger, they're better athletes, and because of this, I think there are, players that really open your eyes, but there are things that are lacking that we'd like to see, we used to see more of years ago than we see today. We don't see the good arms. I'm talking about in players, not pitchers. We see a kid pitcher, he's a kid that's been throwing and throwing and throwing and throwing. But unfortunately, the kids that are players don't throw. They just don't throw enough. You and I grew up, I don't know whether you're a city person or not. You come up in a small town.
I grew up in Long Meadow.
Oh,
small town. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I like to look at it, growing up in the city like I did, and the kids didn't have too much to do. You're down the playground or you're on the street, and you always had some kind of a ball. You were throwing against somebody's steps, somebody's house, but you were playing games with the ball all the time. That arm was always in action, always in motion, and you're moving all the time, always throwing. And how else do you strengthen yourself? Running, you run. Throwing, you throw. But you don't see that anymore. Of course, today everything's all right. We have little leagues. We never had little leagues before. We have pony leagues. We have this league. We have this league. And everything. But everything is organized. Kids are not out there by themselves. Let's say four or five kids. Let's go down the field. Let's, you shag and I'll swing the bat. I'll hit you some puggles. You don't see that anymore. Everything has to be organized. So I think that's the main reason why you don't see the good arms like we had years ago.
What are some of the pluses and minuses of a scout's life?
My wife Jane likes to say that this is the most anti-social life that you can possibly have. And it's understandable that she feels that way. And she's been great about it. But baseball is baseball. It's played every day of the week. And I'm out every day of the week. We don't have vacations. We games from Monday through Sunday, and we have doubleheaders. We're at games every day. No such a thing as a holiday. Holiday means a special ball game. Weddings, I mean, things pertaining to the family. If there's a game that has to be seen that day, I'll be at a game. Bill Lenis of the Boston Red Sox, now a consultant of the Boston Red Sox. He has two daughters, and he always warned his two daughters, if you're going to get married, you don't get married during the baseball season. Okay, or I won't be there. I'm just using that as a, and he's serious. He's serious. But it is, as Gene says, more or less antisocial because you're busy, 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 busy doing that baseball season. And even during the off season, you're busy, busy, busy. Now this is November. I've got 3-4 dates already lined up, but you know you and I got together where we could be together. That's all pertaining to baseball. We have follow-ups that we have to do during the off-season all the time. But the pluses, I choose where I should be going, and that's the big, big part of it, making the best use of your time that's involved, especially given the winter. The spring was short, very, very short, and it's very, very important where you spend each day and how you spend it. Get as much work done. Now, if you have a rainy day, a wet field, you get on that phone, you find out where you can be. I've gone from here to the other side of Bennington, Vermont, where the weather was better than the other side of the mountain because there was ball games there, and there was no ball games this side of the mountain. But there was a ball game there, and I said, well, great. If I can get there, I got to see that particular kid. And this is what it's all about. So every day is different, and every day is so interesting. But rainy days, we don't have to get out and like the everyday guy. He has to get up, be in the office at 8 o'clock and get through work at 5:30, whatever. We make our own time. Our times are sometimes from, well, in March, like in March, I'm in Fort Myers, Florida, and I'm at Terry Park. They're 8 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes I don't get home till after midnight. I may see 4 games. I may see 5 games right there. These are all the colleges that are down there on their spring break. There's a lot of baseball in. You see a lot of ball players. It's a long day. It's a long day, but it's a baseball day.
So you have to do a lot of planning ahead of where you're going to
preparation.
See the greatest number of prospects.
Yeah. A good scout is well prepared. He's well organized. If you're not, you're licked.
I just wanted to say a quick hello.
Oh, I'm sorry. But you
so
know,
preparation.
You
is
asked me a question a while back, and I didn't mean to skip over what was the biggest goof or whatever the goofs. I didn't avoid that. I didn't purposely avoid that.
Yeah, did you have some mistakes or goofs that were memorable as far as, you know?
No, but I'd like to mention this, which I think is giving. It's interesting. We have a kid who lives 8 miles from home, less than 8 miles, the best young pitcher in baseball today. Who is it?
You tell me.
No, you tell me. You're a baseball man.
Well,
the best pitcher in baseball, best young pitcher in baseball. Jason Bellet.
Okay.
The white guy.
Okay.
Saw him in high school, Wilmington High School. I saw him in the summertime with the team in the Intercity League, Wilmington, who, a very good friend of mine, is one of the best umpires around. He formed the team, he put together, and he was one of his pitchers. He had the team for about 3 years, he was one of his pitchers. Now this kid in high school, okay, fine. Not a good student. Kind of a broken home, every kid. I didn't know all this, but I saw him about 5 or 6 innings. I went to another ball game from there. He didn't impress me in independent baseball, in the suburban league, which is a pretty good league. His manager, Pepper Potter, would call and say, hey, Lenny, you're doing well, you're doing great. This is why he's at Middlesex College, who dropped their baseball and then picked it up again, but not much of a program, okay? But the Chicago White Sox scout, just coming into baseball, Chicago White Sox scout, who lives right near the board, drafted him, anyway, because he's good size, and a good arm, 19 years old, no one's going to go to college, couldn't get into college, signed him. But drafted in the 39th round. That tells you something. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have thought too much of him. Well, let's give him a chance to send him out. He's out in the White Sox organization, and a pitching coach by the name of Robinson. Kid puts on about 20, 25 pounds. A beautiful body on him.
Very
good. He's a good looking specimen. He's very impressive. Up with a breaking ball, a falling ball in 89, 99, 92. Progress came along from that. I didn't even turn him in. He lives 5, 6, 7, 8 miles from here, which is a wonderful story of what can happen in those crucial years of between 17 and 21.
Sure.
A boy can develop and can stay at the same level, or he can go the other way.
What advice would you have for new scouts, somebody going in and new with a scout?
Well, today, Bob, we're having more and more younger fellows coming into the field, scouting field, young fellows. It used to be they always put men on with experience in baseball of some type. They didn't have to be a player, so to speak, but we have a lot of young fellows coming into business. They're a cocky bunch, the majority of them. They're so happy to be in baseball, so happy to have that card in their pocket, so happy to carry that book, and so happy to be carrying that ray gun, so happy to be carrying that chair, so happy to be carrying that stopwatch. They're so happy to be part of it. They're over-obsessed with themselves. And now they're trying to impress everybody around them and trying to impress the organization that they're working for. I'm not saying all of them, and we have some good young ones. My advice to the good young ones is to, like I said at the beginning, be prepared, be organized, get to the ball games early, watch infield practice, watch batting practice, and put down in your report what you see and not what you hear. And he's going to be a good scout, because the more he says, the more he's going to, you have to earn the respect of the people around you, the coaches, high school coaches, the college coaches, and then the game gets to be most interesting and you're going to be a successful scout.
Do you have some stories about funny or weird, eccentric, outrageous scouts that you've run into over the years?
You should be talking to Bill Enos. He's got more stories than these. To me, Bill Enos is the epitome of what a scout is all about. Bill Enos. He's been in baseball since he was 15 years old. Played minor league baseball. Managed in the minor leagues. Given the player development field. Ran the minor league camps for Kansas City. Became a scout for many years. And was signed on by the Red Sox because he and Hayward Sutherland were very, very close with Kansas City, you know, and they kept up very, very fond of each other. And of course, one of the first moves that Hayward made was to hire Bill for this job. But he's a typical scout to me. What a scout is all about. He's an honorary touch. Don't get me wrong, he's a Stevenson of the gun. But he's probably the best baseball man. Knows how to evaluate. But his strength is he's a house man. By that I mean he's a powerful baseball man when he gets to visit with that boy and his family. Because
on with Bill Enos, Lenny.
Like I said, to me, he's the image of what a scout is all about. Even carries something, says left-handed all the way, walks like a left-handed. Not a tall man, but heavily built, solid person. But you see him, you see baseball. Got that tan face, got that stubborn cigar in his mouth, he's got that cap way down over his eyes. Sits by himself. Off by himself. Doesn't talk to anybody. But he attracts everybody. Before you know it, they're over there because they just want to say hello, they want to listen to him talk, and he never watches the ball game. Very rarely watches the ball game, but he does it. It's a trick. He's concentrating on them. They're trying to figure who the parents are, the particular ball player that he's looking at, or who's connected with them. He knows everything. He just gets that feeling of what a baseball scout should be. And he works very, very quietly in the background. You never know who he's interested in. You never know how high he is on a boy, or whether he doesn't like the particular boy you're concentrating. You never know. What he puts down on paper is what Bill Enos himself wants to put down on paper. And he's been a very successful scout over the years.
That leads me to the next question. If you could name the first five scouts to go into the Hall of Fame, who would they be and why?
You know, Bill, I got a letter from Bill Guilfoyle of the Baseball Hall of Fame a year or so ago, and I still have the letter. He asked me to do that. You know, and I thought about it. And if I couldn't name the first five. I couldn't. I'd have to give you 105. I mean that.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that you can say, this guy's number one, this guy's number two, this other, because we have so many good scouts. Men that are so dedicated and give their lives. But everybody's different. Everybody works different. I could classify some of the good scouts, like I said. Like Bill Enos, like I said, he's the best house man. You get him in the house, he's going to sign that kid. Or he's not leaving. And he has more, well, I could tell you more stories that I know because I've been in competition with Bill in signing boys over the years. And to me, the best digger of all the scouts is a fellow named Ralph DeLulo, who I worked with for over 40 years with the Cubs and the scouting bureau. He's the best digger of them all. He is now probably 80 years old, 81, back working with the Cubs because we had a cutback of 50% and they retired him a year ago, but the Cubs took him on now and more or less a part-time base, but he's still out there. Got two artificial hips, walks with a cane, never misses a day. He's sees more ball games than any three scouts put together. That's what I call a digger. He turns names in. Everybody to him is a ball player until proven otherwise, which is a good way to do it. With him in that New York and Pennsylvania, New Jersey and that area down there, he keeps all those scouts hopping and skipping. If he wasn't working, they wouldn't know where the hell to go. That's Ralph DeLulo. The best organized, Jimmy Marks, who I worked with for over 20 years with the Major League Scouting Bureau. And this year he seized on an opportunity to go with the Atlanta Braves. Just couldn't turn down what they offered him. He's out of Lima, Ohio. He's the best organized. He's the scout that I would most want to see if I was a scout. If I was a young ball player. His mimeograph forms in our business so much. That's Jimmy Marks. Like I say, I could name 105. I know at least 105 who I would want to see in that Hall of Fame.
Do any come up to the top as far as evaluators of talent, more so than others?
Yes, yeah. And those fellows usually, given the position, they should be. Cross-checkers. In other words, if I like a boy, next year here in this area we have five or six boys that could go in the early rounds. That is, that's up right now. Maybe the spring comes around and we won't feel that way and they haven't progressed or whatever. But right now we have five or six boys. And I turn on the reports and then we'll have a man come in and check them out. See if he likes me as much as I do. So they're supposed to be fellas that can evaluate. However, they have my report to read too before they come in here, so they do have a job. But as far as picking out some fellas being better than others and evaluating talent, Bob, you and I can go out. We have no trouble. This kid's a ball player. He's peaked out. He's not going to get any better. Well, this boy is going to be a good college ball player, the best. There's no problem with doing that. Scouting isn't a deal enough. If you're a baseball fan, if you love baseball, the kid will tell you himself whether he's a good prospect or not. You don't have to be a wizard up here. You, like you say, you could wish you could cut them open and look inside of them, because there are things, and this is where the Scouting Bureau comes in. We give them ISOM tests, we give them eye tests, we give them all kinds of programs maybe to actually look inside of them. But that doesn't tell the whole story either.
Now, when you were
Pete Rose. Pete Rose. I was going to mention him earlier. I saw him play in 1960. Do you remember the dinner up there? He was invited up to Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
He was sitting next to Gene. No way.
Uh-huh.
I have a report. When I saw him in 1960, he had the greatest A tops, double A tops, triple A tops, and one major league top. Okay. I graded him out as A tops. Never gonna go any higher than A baseball. Not many other scouts ever felt he didn't go any higher than A ball when he saw him his first year. The second baseman weighed about 150 pounds. And all he could do was hustle. He hit about 235. You could tell me what he hit. I'm just guessing. I know he didn't hit 250 his first year, but hustle. He made himself a ball player. Got to be 190, 195 pounds, strong, great hitter, terrific ball player, great instinct, great everything. But my report his first year was class A. Gene knew the story. he's sitting next to me. He's the same up there at the dinner as he is out in the field. You know,
yeah.
Taking everything in, you know, not paying attention to anybody. You know. Jane finally said to him, I guess my husband on the report he has on you. Not paying attention to him. A little while later, she said it out loud. Why don't you ask my husband about the report he has on you when you were a rookie? Kind of looked at her, and he did this to me. What year that class? First year, 1960. Where that class? In Geneva, New York. Who was my manager?
Manager Van Dell.
Who played third base? I said, Tony Brook. He said, God damn it, you did see me. I'll never forget it. He said, what's this about a report you have? And I told him, I said, I'm going to think you're going to be better than an A ball player. I said, but you made yourself a ball player. And I'm so proud of you, you know, I try to soften up my report. He said, send it to me. Send that report. Just like that. Send it to me. I said, I will not. He said, why not? I said, great, you have it in the Sporting News and all the periodicals that goddamn bump scout up there in New England had you as the Class A target ball player and you were the first $100,000 single hitter. No, but I just want to have a lot of fun with it. I said, no. 2 weeks later, this Joe, what was his name? I got to know him well. He was this, one of his coaches with Cincinnati. And I knew him when he was a manager in the Eastern League. He called me up. He says, what's this about you got a report on Pete? I said, yeah, I have it. He said, do me a favor, Senator. He wants to have something. He told us all about it. And this secretary in the Red office called me. She says, what's this about you having a Babe Ruth and a Ted Williams and a Ty Cobb bat? I said, yes, I do. She said, would you like to have a Pete Rose bat? I said, no. You know, I know what
you knew what they were up to.
Yeah. I said, no. I said, Pete Rose bat, I'd love to have one, but doesn't mean to me. Because the other bat's just how I got them. I said, all his bats are in the Hall of Fame, although he's not giving up any bats, that's the most important. He said, well, just send a copy of that. She talked, and I finally said, okay, if Phil sent me a bat with a note saying that this bat was used by me specifically, so forth and so on, I'll send you a copy of the note. That was the end. I never heard anything more about it.
Oh, you didn't get it?
No, I never said that.
After you scouted with the for the Cubs for till 1973, then you were assigned to the Major League Scouting Bureau.
Yeah.
Tell us how that changed your role as a scout from the Cubs to the Major League Scouting Bureau.
Well, number one, I'll explain how, like you say, I was assigned, and that's the way I put it too. I was assigned. We were told, we knew that we were going to have a Major League Baseball Scouting Bureau. At that time, they were even calling it the Central Scouting Bureau, like they do in football. You know, four teams will have a staff, another four teams have another staff, and so forth. But this was, they would call it the Central Scouting Bureau. But we were told by our peers in Chicago, our bosses in Chicago, our directors, the general managers, and so forth, if we get a call from the Major League Scouting Bureau, first of all, Jim Wilson was named the director, and Don Priest was named the assistant director. And they were to put together 55 or 60 men and form the Major League Scouting Bureau. I was on the original Major League Scouting Bureau, which was on a trial basis a few years before that. Baseball wanted to try it in the different areas. So I was on loan from the Cubs, and I did the New England area as a member of this new, and B.D. Hensel directed it right from the Wrigley building. He had a few of us fellows working, and they proved that it could work. So I knew a little bit about it. And we were told, if we get a call from the Scouting Bureau, notify the office quick, and they would let you know whether they would like to have you go with the Bureau or not. You didn't have to go. And the only way, they said, you go, or we don't want you to go. every club felt the same way. If you were selected by the Bureau, they were only too glad to let you go. I mean, number one, they didn't have to pay your salary, didn't have to pay your expenses. The Bureau was going to pay you, and they knew just how you worked. They knew you, how you evaluated and everything else, which was a big plus for them. So when I got the call, I called the Cubs, and Beanie Hensel and Gene Loring and John Holland said, Len, look, you know you're a Cubs player, we know you're the Cubs. He said, but I think you'd be in a band. They'll raise your salary, you'll be on a good pension plan. And so it was going to upgrade the whole scouting system. So I wound up fine. I still wake up to the Cubs scores every morning, you know, but I'm now working for the Bureau, and I'm working for the Cubs too. And, but immediately, you work different. Like I said, you don't want to get too close to the boys, don't get too close to the family, which you had to do before they had the draft. Because before the draft, yeah, you know, you get to know the boy, you get to know his mother, you get to know his father, you get to know his coach, you get to know everybody, because you wanted them to get to know you and know that you're a sincere person and you had their interest in mind. You're not just out there to sign the boy. That's what it was all before the draft. And the same way with, now that I'm with the Bureau and as against working for the Cubs, you didn't want to get too close to the boy. You try to find out as much as you possibly can. But you don't want to, this is as a team scout, not as with the Bureau, so I'm going to get me a little confused on that. So the team scouts, they're not supposed to get too close to them. But with the Bureau, we still get in there and get to know the families well because we have to give them an eye test. We give them an ISOM test, that's a sports motivation test, which takes about 3/4 to an hour for a boy to take. But meanwhile, while we're giving the boy the test, we're busy with the family. He takes the test in another room. We're busy with the family. Let them get to know you. It's getting you in the house, so forth and so on. And this gets you in there pretty close and getting to know what the boy's all about. And we have nothing to do with grading the test or anything. That goes to a special testing concern out there in California. And they grade all these tests. And usually, doesn't have any problem, but every once in a while it shows the boy should not go into professional sports because of the type of test they take.
This is a test that kind of
it's a true
tells whether you got motivation.
I love my high school coach when I was playing for him in high school. That might be one of the questions, true, false, or maybe. But they have trick questions in there. In amongst there's 4 pages of true, false, or maybe. And if they're able to say whether this boy is for this type of business.
Mm-hmm.
They found out years ago the boy did pass it, and they still drafted him in the first round. Remember a player by the name of Ivy, the catcher?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, I did.
He failed that test. And, he just couldn't feel comfortable in the clubhouse, or feel comfortable traveling, feel comfortable with
the boys. He had a lot of talent as a baseball
player. Right. Number one pick out of Georgia. And it's a must. We give these boys tests that grade up 45 and above. As I say, it's not just a boy can play or he can't play.
Do you feel that your role is less competitive than with the Major League Scouting Bureau than it used to be? In other words, when you were with the Cubs, you wanted to find people to sign up with the Cubs.
Right
now, with the Major League Scouting Bureau, that competition is gone. Is that
right?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, we try to concentrate on the boy and grading him out where and how we feel and what position the boy should be drafted in. In other words, how much of an expenditure is it going to be? Is he signable? In other words, we have to know, can he go to a fine school, fine college, how much of a scholarship is he getting at that particular school, will the college scholarship program from the professional team make a difference? There's so much more involved in it. But we have to concentrate on, number one, we don't want to be embarrassed in the area. We want to know every player possible that has or should be given a chance, an opportunity to go into professional baseball. We don't want to miss anybody. So we're out there working harder than ever. I'm working harder than ever with the Bureau than ever. And I always worked hard with the Cubs there because it's a big, big, big area. But it was impossible to cover all that area. I don't care how much help you had. But now you're supposed to, we don't have that big of an area, although it's expanded again now because we have less men working. You don't want to be embarrassed. And you want to pinpoint this guy. This guy is the first, second, or third round draft for this one. And the reasons why.
Do you feel now that the Bureau has been going for quite some time now that it's fulfilling its objectives?
The Bureau is doing more than they ever anticipated doing because they've come up with different ideas to help all the ball clubs. We're getting as much information. Now we get medical forms that we have to fill out, and that's 6 pages long. Each kid that we feel is a prospect, we visit the home and he has to fill out this medical form and signed by his parents. We have cameramen. We have 3 cameramen throughout the country, the West, Middle West, and the East. Cameramen, just putting on camera the better prospects. In other words, if he's a pitcher, you'll see this guy behind us, say it's a good pitcher, say the kid from Stone and Mass, put him in for fishing. We'll have a cameraman on him next spring. And they'll record this form out there, putting it right on film. And how hard he's throwing, what his velocity is, where his breaking ball is, and so forth. Now, it's a player. They'll get out there, take infield practice, catch him during the ball game, catch him at the plate, catch his running time going to first base. They'll record everything. And a tape is made of every one of the leading kids and sent to every one of the golf clubs. And they'll use that with the reports when they're putting their list down, number one pick, number two pick, number three pick. Then we put a book out just before the draft out who we think is number one, two, three. That goes to all of us. If they use the Bureau as a supplement, that's what they should be doing. They're doing their own thing, but use us as a supplement. Plus, us feeding them all these side things that try to tell them as much about a particular boy as possible.
And it's really working as far as developing a greater number of prospects than you were able to under the scouting system itself.
Right.
Because you've got more, you're concentrating on an area more than used to be scouted before.
Oh, there's so much more to scouting now than ever. Yes. I love to tell a story about Joe Cronin and Joe Dugan. I know you must have heard it. Joe Dugan was
Jumping Joe Dugan?
Jumping Joe.
Yeah.
He loved to come to me. He loved Gene. Gene would always have every excuse to come by the house, whether I'm out watching a ball game or not. And he never took a note of his life. But the Joe from General Manager left us, and they kept it busy. Joe, get out and see this boy, get out and see that boy. Never, he'd sit next to you. How about that? How about that? But it could be ribs or be broken by the time the ball game deal. Joe Cronin's son, Corky, was down at Canterbury School down in Connecticut, just to give Joe something. Well, here it is, Joe. Two of them. It's desk. I said, written on it. Joe said, Cronin said, Joe, there's no report on a boy. He said, turn it over. Cronin turned it over, written on the other side was, I'll take the old man. In other words, you could play, but you can't play. That was Joe way of coming.
Lenny, you're a young...
There was one that, you know, I just... Jeff Jones.
Uh-huh.
Died at the age of 92. I was...
Former scout for the Boston Braves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he signed more big league ball players than most scouts. I just cleaned my desk out the other day, and that was in one of the papers. What I've done, I've got a telephone directory downstairs, one of the old hardcover directories, ABC, and there's a player, like, let's say Jim Hegan, when he died, well, I cut it out from the local paper or the sporting news or whatever, and I put it with the agents. I'm surprised at how many players that I knew, or fellas like that I knew that I have in that book.
Yeah.
They've all grown up. You remember Jeff Jones? Do you remember? No.
No, I don't. Yeah. I see he signed Joe Morgan, the
But he worked for the days with the Braves when $4,000 was the limit.
Yeah.
He used to scout for scouts. And I used to tell him. He was a great teacher. He taught at Newton High School. He was up in Andover. He was always one of my favorite people. He was a scholar. The hat. Old Yankee. His wife was a school teacher. She's a beautiful person. She's still with him. And later on in life, when he retired from Braves, when they just cut him out, I don't know, when he signed all the things, and we had a scouts, New England Scouts organization. We used to meet out in Pleasant Valley once a month during the offseason just to keep baseball going. Shorten the way up there. But it was wonderful. We had dinner together. I drive my car up to Andover. He always had a big Chrysler, but he would drive at night. So I leave my car there and drive him on the way to Pleasant Valley. I'm going to Worcester, beautiful golf course, nice, beautiful back. Bring it back later, I pick up on the car. From the way going, on the way coming. It was an education because he would talk about astronomy. He was just a born teacher, an intellectual, and it was so interesting that I used to just sit there and listen to him. He'd explain everything. One trip would be geography, another trip would be this and be that, but always a very interesting man, and we would talk baseball too. So he was always just to be one of my favorite people. Yeah. But he signed a lot of players. But I say, he used to scout the scouts. When he worked for Perrine, he had money. He saw me talking to a boy. The next thing I know, that kid was offered $4,000. You couldn't offer a kid more than $4,000. But a kid that we would say give $500 to, he'd just step in and give him a $4,000 contract. As long as it wasn't more than $4,000, that'd be a bonus ball for him. And we didn't like that. So we used to set him up. I got more kids, opportunities in baseball.
They get their $4,000, but they weren't too good.
Well, they could get their $4,000, and you could select the $4,000 any way you wanted. That included your salary for your first year, the $4,000. How do you want $2,000 and $2,000? You know, things like that. But like seven, not the four. I wouldn't say anything like that, but the Jackamo. I liked him. I don't think it's an age of prospect. It wasn't any better. But I liked the kid. Wanted an opportunity to play in the first place. And I said, look, he told me that Mr. Jones is going to be on Wednesday. I said, well, here's what I like to have you do. It's going to help you. Leave my car on the dining room table and have some on the dining room table. He's going to see that guy. He's going to see that, John. I guarantee you. You call me up that night. Tell me that you signed with the Braves. And you got $4,000.
And he did, huh?
That was how we, Jeff, because, you know, you all the way back by it once in a while. It was that Belgium kid from Lexington. Signed with the, I went to his wedding buffet at our wedding, graduation high school, Western High School. And another fellow was there, was a bunch there for the buffet after, you know, after the graduation exercise, the family had everybody there, and I was invited to the house, and I offered him $1,000. But right during the buffet, I offered him $1,000 plus a salary. And ready to sign. The trainer, the selections in high school. I'll never forget his name was Bertini. Stallone. He had to be there too. And he found out at the party, they're all congratulating for the pilot attempt. And Bertini steps in and he says, I have a very, very good friend I want to know that you can sign. Jeff Jones. He called Jeff Jones. Jeff signed that night and gave $4,000. The kid went to the big ones. He wasn't going to sign him, but he knew I was interested in signing.
You mentioned earlier that when you first started scouting, your salary was $4,500.
Yep.
What is the salary range, the general salary range today for a major league scout?
Well, today they're assigning younger players, younger scouts, younger fellas, usually fellas that have been doing some coaching in colleges, junior college. I'm just thinking of like the Toronto scouts. And of course, Toronto's making a lot of money up here. I understand they started him out at $30,000. Plus their expenses, they keep busy all year round, they run him around everywhere. He's a good man. Teddy Leakes, I've never asked what they make and so forth, but you know, the Cub Scouts, they make no tip, they're starting at $25,000. I think what they, if they want a man badly, and they want to make him a full-time man, they give him an area, they're probably starting at about $25,000 to $30,000. I'm talking about that figure there. Some ball clubs will work in two ways. They'll give them a car and have to turn the car in every 2 years, or they give them full expenses with the car, whatever expenses you have with the car, returns it. In other words, when he puts gas in the car, he gives them the gas money. I'm talking about this thing, but of course, next you get your hotel and whatever expenses they have, your stamps, all that. Use cars and some clubs don't. But salary range, I cannot see them signing a young man to a full-time scouting job now unless they give him $25,000. Some of them pay a little better, some of them pay less, depending on the organization they would. Scouts are never overpaid. You know.
You do it for the
Definitely. However, it hasn't. Yeah, I wouldn't trade it for anything.